Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Nick.
Hello.
We're joined by Nick Means. Nicholas Means? What do you like to go by?
Nick's great.
Nick Means.
We're joined by Nick. The Means is short for Means Serious Business. Means.
I did promise Sean he could say that.
He gave me permission to make whatever puns I want to make about his name, which was probably not a smart decision.
Probably not.
Although that's the only one I've got, so maybe I'll think more. We'll see.
So you are... I don't actually know your official title. Engineering leader is what
VP of engineering at Move Health is my official title.
Okay. And yeah. So you are one of the few people to have an entire episode of this show dedicated to something that you did. So we figured we should have you on the podcast.
Yeah, I felt a little left out when I listened to that episode.
Like they know how to get in contact with me. They could have just had me on. So we talked about your keynote from RailsConf in Kansas City, right?
Yeah, 2015?
Yep.
Yeah.
Which was the first time that I think I'd ever seen one of your talks. It was the first time I'd met you. And then, you know, I was like, I don't know what to expect here, but I met this guy at the speaker dinner before, so I'm going to go. And so I went and was blown away. It was just an awesome story. And then at the end, I was like, oh, yeah, also it's applicable. And it was a good story.
It is a good story.
I feel like that's kind of your brand in your talks. Is that what you go for?
It's what I've stumbled into, yeah. No, it works well for me. I like the storytelling part of it, and being able to tie it into what we do for a living is a bonus at the end.
Right. And so like the talk at, we'll link it to the show notes when this comes out for the episode that we did previously, but that was about Skunkworks at Lockheed,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that talk got me to read a book, which is a feat. So I read the Skunkworks book and was like, wow, this is even better. Like, there's even more here than
there's
in the
so
talk.
Much there.
It was so great. And then the talk you gave yesterday was about Three Mile Island.
Hmm?
And you talked about a book there called, what's the title of the book?
Atomic Accidents.
No, not that one.
Not that one? Okay.
Nope. The one, the Human
President's
Error one.
Report.
The Human Error one.
Well, that one. I talked about a lot of books. That's Field Guide to Understanding Human Error by Sidney Decker.
Yes, and that was the one I took a picture of and was like, he's got me again. I'm going to read another
book. Yeah, that's a phenomenal book.
Because one of the things that I took away from that talk is you had, I don't know if it's from that book or your original line, but basically saying that human error is never the cause or never the problem.
That's straight from the book, yeah.
Okay, and so why don't you tell us a little bit more about that idea?
About that idea?
Yeah.
Well, it's often when things go wrong or there's an accident, we often reach to blame the people involved. It's human instinct to do that because it's really convenient for us because that's where our brains go immediately when something happens. But it's almost never the true cause of what happens. Even when somebody makes a poor decision or does something that's obviously incorrect, there's something that taught them to make that decision or encouraged them to make that decision. And so only by digging into those underlying causes can you figure out what actually happened and why it happened and keep it from happening again.
Yeah, I think the Challenger disaster is a really good example of basically exactly that, right? Where there was a very, very specific engineering decision, and a lot of people who could specifically be blamed and were at the time. But that led into a whole investigation into Go Fever at NASA and why people, when the engineers knew that this was not hardware capable of launching in freezing conditions, why they tried to launch the rocket when it was 20 degrees outside.
Right. Why didn't they scrub?
Right. And there are so many people who could have prevented it and knew about this risk and all chose not to act. Yeah, it was not the fault of the flight director who probably would have made the final call. It's not the fault of the engineers who created the O-rings that failed in the first place. It was a systematic cultural failure.
Yeah, and one of the things Decker talks about in the book is that safety and productivity are always at tension in any organization.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, if you optimize for perfect safety, you can't get anything done. And if you optimize for perfect productivity, you're almost certainly doing things unsafely. So you have to find the equilibrium in any given situation.
There's the Challenger thing reminded me, there's a great video that was the New York Times put out around the 25th anniversary. Was that around about a few years ago?
That was very, that was, I think.
A couple years ago?
Two years ago.
25th anniversary of that Challenger disaster. And the video, it's called a retro report. And so it just talks about, like, it does the whole, like, oh, okay, it was the O-ring fault or whatever. And then they go into, like, no, let's look at the culture here. And then, unfortunately, I believe this is the same video where they kind of revisit it at the end and talk about Columbia. And how, like, you know, different technical failure.
Right.
But perhaps some of the same, like, underlying cultural things that kind of led to it. But
right.
I think that one was much more of a lack of proper contingency planning. Because, I mean, they knew that was going to burn up on reentry, you know, long before they tried, but there was no sort of safety plan in place in case something went wrong.
Yeah, and they didn't have enough life support on the shuttle to develop the plans while they were in orbit.
Right, exactly.
They just had to try it.
And I mean, now of course, it's much easier to have a backup plan because the space station is there. And basically, I believe any crewed flights, even that are interplanetary, are going to launch into an orbit where they could potentially rendezvous with the ISS if needed. Which, I mean, if you're going to go to Mars, I don't know that a 53-degree inclined orbit is going to be a terribly efficient thing to do. So we'll see if they follow through on that. But it's much easier to have a contingency plan when we literally have life support for humans up in space.
Right. So, like, I feel like a lot of your talks, although not the first one I saw, but, you know, you also have, like, a plane crash talk, which is good. 3 Mile Island. So, you're big on disasters, I can see.
I do like
and
disasters,
And so,
yeah.
We had kind of, like, a timely, just yesterday, speaking of, like, initial first story. Your talk talks about the first story is what you think of immediately to blame. And then the second story is, like, well, what actually happened? So, yesterday, after the talk, there was an accident on a Southwest flight, which had a emergency landing, and unfortunately, somebody lost their life. And then I started to see things come across Twitter that was like, here's a first story. And I'm like categorizing it in my head. And then this morning I saw something interesting that was like a picture of people who had, you know, the masks came down and they had put the masks around their mouths, but not covering their noses. And the comment was like, look at these people. You have to listen. Like, you have to listen to the space, to the space people. To the flight attendants when they're giving the safety briefing. Like, you're all using this wrong. And then it's just like, well, are they using it wrong or is it maybe designed wrong if that's how people act in a crisis?
Yeah, I mean, a little nose notch and that problem is solved. That's all it takes.
Right.
Well, I honestly think you can start to bring human error here a little bit more because we're also talking about people whose first thought was, oh, let me get a periscope going before I put my oxygen mask on. Not necessarily the brightest, brightest ideas.
That's Twitter's fault. But I think it's going to be interesting to see that story develop, like, into the what is the actual underlying cause, and we'll get one of those, you know, detailed reports, I'm sure. And
The interesting thing about that is there's actually a federal airworthiness directive that's pending that would likely require more frequent inspections of those CFM56 fan disks. Just hasn't been implemented yet because there was a very similar incident on Southwest back in 2016.
And so the thinking, there's nothing like official as far as I know of what happened basically is that like something, a blade broke off of the fan.
From what I could see from the pictures, it looks like, the fan tossed a blade. And the thing that happened in 2016, they resolved that the blade came out the front of the engine somehow. And that's not supposed to happen. It shouldn't discharge debris out the front of the engine. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the same thing happened yesterday.
Right.
It threw a blade, came out of the front of the engine, and unfortunately impacted one of the windows on the plane.
Right. And so there's going to be a second story here of like, if we knew this was a thing.
Right. Yeah.
Why didn't we move faster?
Directive not in place.
Right.
And, yeah. And we know pretty well at this point how to keep these things from breaking off.
We do. Yeah. We're pretty good at keeping titanium functional at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. As you were mentioning yesterday, that'll be interesting to see since the new engines that are being used on the 37-800.
Mm-hmm. And the 787.
And the 787 are carbon fiber instead of titanium, which we don't necessarily have as much experience with when it comes to planes.
Right. Well, and the testing methods that you would use for a titanium disc don't work at all on carbon fiber.
Right.
Because so much of it's like eddy current based type magnetic inspection, and carbon fiber is obviously not conductive.
Right.
Interesting. So how do you identify, when you're preparing talks, how do you identify what stories you think will make good talks?
I ingest a lot of stories. That's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. I read a lot and a lot of very varied things. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons for that is that software engineering as a discipline is really young in terms of human perspective. We haven't been doing it all that long.
Yeah.
And so as someone who cares deeply about engineering leadership and leading well, I think there's a lot to be learned by looking outside of software engineering for lessons. And so that's a lot of what I'm doing. Writing the talks just gives me the excuse to spend a month or two deep diving on one of these things and doing a meditation on it, essentially.
Yeah. I will say, like, the talks that are more, like, story-based like that are the ones that I go home and I'm like, hey, Christina, that's my wife's name. Like, let's watch this talk when it comes out. It's, like, a great story. It's really cool. So I think those are fun to share. And then the fact that you can, like I said, that you can loop them back in and be like, well, there's something to learn here for everybody.
Right.
It's awesome.
I'm hoping to try and crib your style for a conference. you've seen the pitch, but basically a talk about the Gemini program specifically and why, even though it was designed to develop all the technology required to go to the moon, why we then also separately developed Apollo as opposed to going with any of the many, many, many proposals that would have involved Gemini going to the moon, which probably would have got us there cheaper and faster. And I think both the program itself is just fascinating to look at from a software developer's point of view. Just why was this one craft able to develop so many things that we had never done before? Both rendezvous, docking, the first spacewalk, the length of orbits changed, and the Gemini 4, I believe, was the first. I can't be right. I think it was Gemini 4 that was the first crewed one, but did not have the life support for the two-week flight that eventually happened, but also didn't have the hardware required for them to add that, and it was just the modular design of it that let them swap that out. But I think that's very interesting, and then also the fact that it didn't go to the moon has some great parallels in software as well, because ultimately it was not a technical problem, because nothing ever gets killed by technical problems. It was a people problem, and basically when politics leaks into engineering, which, I mean, if you're at NASA, is impossible to not have happen, but that can kill projects.
I think it's impossible not to have happen anywhere. I mean,
that's true.
Politics always leaks into what we do.
That is very true. Gemini's really cool, though. If you've never looked into it, like you should.
Gemini, huh?
That is how they pronounce it, yeah.
Huh. I've always said Gemini.
I have as well.
I used to, and then I did some research on it and like watched, you know, some clips of old news reports from that time, and it was very definitely specifically pronounced Gemini.
Huh. Okay, interesting. I wanted to pivot, if we can, for a moment.
All right.
Because I know as a VP of engineering, you must have a hand in hiring, right?
I do.
Building your team. When I come to these conferences, often people will ask me advice on how they can make themselves stand out when they're trying to get hired, or people who are fresh out of boot camps or things like that. Like, how do I separate myself? They see it as like nobody will hire people out of a boot camp. But as somebody who's reviewing resumes, I see we just get a lot of people that come out of boot camps, and it takes a lot to stand out. And so I try and give some advice on ways that people in that situation, or really in any situation, can stand out. What do you look for? This is a conversation I've had with a few people in particular, like in that initial sort of like, here's a pile of resumes, and however you get them in some sort of HR system or whatever, you get those these days. Like, what is it that makes somebody stand out?
This will probably not surprise you, but I look for stories.
Yeah, cover letter.
Cover letter, or even in the resume, I look for not a list of skills I have acquired, but a list of impacts that I have had on the businesses I've been a part of. Mm-hmm. And so displaying impact, I mean, it's sort of like in baseball stats right now, the big thing is wins above replacement. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the same sort of thing. You're looking for somebody who can join your team that will make your team as a whole better.
The value over replacement higher.
Yeah.
Vor.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. What I tell people is, like, I don't usually look at a resume all that in that detailed of a fashion. And what instead, like, on the ThoughtBot application, we ask, like, a few questions. Mm-hmm. And so I look at those to tell me, I guess I've never really thought of it, I'm looking for you to tell me a story. I've always put it to people, I'm looking for you to show me that you, like, put some care into this and, like, thought about what we're looking for and how you fit into that.
Right.
In areas where you might do even more than I was anticipating or something like that.
Right. Well, and you get a feel for their ability to communicate, and I think that's incredibly important and often overlooked, you know, because technical ability can help let you write software, but you have to be able to communicate to write correct software that actually fits business need.
I don't think we want to accept, like, if you meet the technical qualifications and are generally a reasonable person at communicating, I don't think we like to think about how much actually we probably are more interchangeable than we'd like to pretend. And I kind of think, to a certain extent, hiring is less about finding the candidate who's going to accelerate your team so much, because any qualified candidate will do about the same amount of work. But a bad candidate can absolutely trash a team.
Yep, that's true.
Yeah, and that's, at ThoughtBot, we don't do remote work for the most part. Like, we allow you to work remotely when needed, but not like as a lifestyle thing.
Right.
And so one of the things I've been talking to people about is, like, you know, as more and more companies allow for this, it's harder for us to compete. But we also need to recognize that, like, the single reason that people enjoy coming to work for ThoughtBot ultimately is the people that they get to work with every day. So if we make a mistake there, it's going to cost us more than just, like, oh, well, that was a mistake in hire and maybe we have to let that person go.
Right.
It's going to cost us other people as well when they're like, well, there's some other disadvantages about this job. And also, like, I'm not really enjoying coming to work with these people every day.
Right.
So we have to make sure that they really enjoy coming to work with those people every day. And I'm sure that's true also in a remote context. Like, you have to also enjoy working with the people. It's just that you will not be next to them all day.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if anything, it requires people that have a higher level of empathy, because you have to allow for each other's communication foibles over distance, because it takes more work to communicate in a remote organization. It's not necessarily a drawback. It ends up that you get more written communication that way. So you have an archive of the communication that's happened, and you can look back on it and look back on decisions. it just requires you to do things differently.
I don't think it's wrong for Thoughtbot to disallow remote work. I personally don't like working remotely. I work better when I have an office to go to, and I'm better at communicating in person than over chat. Like, if there's anybody on your team who is remote, you are now a remote team. Mm-hmm. I think there will always be a place for companies that explicitly don't allow remote work for the people who don't want to work remotely, which is, you know, of course, a shrinking demographic, but there will always be some people.
Yeah, there will. I mean, and that's one of the things that you end up talking about quite a bit in the interview is, okay, do you have a place with a door that can close that you can work in?
Right.
Because you don't want somebody who's trying to work from their kitchen table. It's not going to work well for them. And if it's their first remote job, they may just not know that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How does onboarding work when, like, somebody is like, I've only started 3 jobs post-college in my life, but like, it's always been a process of like, I sit with somebody and, you know, they show me everything that I need to know for a little bit. And then,
I mean, it's not particularly different. It's just done over a video call usually.
Yeah.
I mean, guess. If you're going to be working remotely, it seems like showing you everything that you're going to be doing remotely can be done remotely.
Yeah, I guess. Turn around. There's your office door. Close it.
Yep. My company has an office in Denver. So sometimes we'll bring new people into the office in Denver and I'll fly up and hang out with them for a day or two.
Cool. So we talked about like trying to tell a story with either your resume or, you know, whatever, in a cover letter or whatever form that might take. Mm-hmm. What about for people who their story just isn't super long career-wise yet, right? So we're talking about like recent bootcamp grads, recent college grads. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you think that they can do to separate themselves?
I mean, I've hired quite a few bootcamp grads, and the ones that end up standing out for me, again, are still the ones that are able to tell a story, because they do a significant number of projects in bootcamp in a very compressed time frame. And so there's always stories they can tell about the projects that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I haven't hired a lot of recent college grads.
Okay.
So,
yeah. I mean, to me, I think it's similar. Like I said, the story angle is something new to me, and I'm going to try that, I think. But but to me, it's like, I get a lot of applications that are like, here are the 3 applications I did during my boot camp, and like I got 7 applications from the same boot camp and they're the same projects, and
right.
Like, and other than the names, these right. are the same thing. And so you really have to think about like, how did what I do here differ from what my teammates did, or how can I present this in a way that shows what I learned or shows
that's what I would want
shows
to see.
A trajectory it, of
what
like
did I, what did I learn, what did I overcome, what did I struggle with in this project, what did right. those struggles teach me?
Right. And the other thing I suggest to people, like when I do review, sometimes people will ask for like feedback, like, hey, can you give me any advice on what to do from here? Actually, right. I'm getting that more and more. And what I try and tell them is specifically things like, ways in which they might stick out from people in the similar situation would be like, don't just show me like, here's the code I wrote. Show me like an example that like you're submitting pull requests and doing code review, and like do something like that. If you can do that and show that like, not only do I know how to do the technical work, I know how a team functions when they're writing software.
Right.
Right. And I write good commit messages and I like take care that all that stuff is in line.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think you're going to find good commit messages from code written during a boot camp though.
Because it's under fire.
That's
is
true.
That what
yeah, it's under very intense time pressure, and they also, you know, it's also their first software project, so they
right.
Haven't necessarily learned, even if they've been told, they certainly haven't internalized the importance of that yet.
Right, and maybe don't even know why a thing that they changed
right.
worked, and
right.
they're just like, I don't know, this worked.
Yeah.
And I know the same thing, but sometimes I try and expand on it.
I mean, I think another thing that can be helpful, especially for bootcamp grads, is most of them have been through a portion of another career before they've done a bootcamp. And so if they can tie that picture together and show how that brings value to the team that they're trying to step into, because it's always there. That story's always there.
Yeah. And that's advice I give people as well. Is like I say, what did you do before? Tell me a little bit about that. Like, tell me about how, you know, you worked your way from X to Y, or mm-hmm. like what skills you think you learned there that will apply to this job.
Right. Kind of thing.
These are definitely things that I mean, bootcamp grads are becoming a larger and larger percentage of the market. So it's definitely a thing that we're gonna have to get better at figuring out. What do we want to look for specifically from that group of people?
And I think the answer differs potentially based on the company, obviously.
Sure.
Like I think
right.
that what a large product company organization can do as far as apprenticeship and mentorship and how long that ramp can be
right.
is different from what somebody, a consulting company can do or a small right. startup can do.
And that's, I mean, at Move, we haven't hired any bootcamp grads yet, and it's because of that. It's because I know that we cannot support them well where we are as a business right now.
Well, you haven't hired them as their first job out of a bootcamp.
Correct. Correct.
How big is the team that you have now at Move?
6.
Okay,
six cool. engineers, yeah.
And what does Move do?
We build surgery centers to do hip and knee replacements.
Okay.
And my team builds the software that the clinicians use to chart and to guide patients through the process.
Are you hiring?
At the moment, no, we are not.
So all this is theoretical advice on how to get Nick's attention.
It is.
But when the time comes.
When the time comes.
Can we get like a coupon code going so that our listeners can go to movehealth.com/bikeshed and get 10% off 10% a hip and knee replacement? I'm still mad that you haven't managed to get me a coupon for a free knee replacement.
Free knee. I think you'd have to talk to the federal government about that because I think it's technically illegal for us to do that.
Cool. What else haven't we asked you about that you want to talk about?
That's a good question.
What are you excited about these days? Like when you come to work, what's the problem you're excited about solving?
So I think in healthcare, there's a tendency to shove software down clinicians' throats instead of asking them what would actually make their jobs better. And so our team has the opportunity to work really closely with a group of clinicians and actually try to help them figure out how to tell us what software would make their jobs better. Mm-hmm. Because it's something they don't really know how to express either.
Right.
And so it's been fun to work through that process and try to figure out how to get that information from them.
Right. And figuring out the underlying, like the old, is the Henry Ford quote of like, if I asked people what they wanted, it would have been a faster horse.
Yeah.
So trying to avoid the like, I want X, and really understanding like, why do you want X?
What is the pain point we're trying to address here? Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. So we have whole processes around trying to do that. But so the clinicians, how far removed are they? Are they the people who you directly use the software and that you sell the software to?
So it's all internal software, so we're not selling it. Yeah.
All right. So that's all like, okay, I get the model now. Got it.
I do think it's interesting. That can either be something that becomes really freeing because you don't necessarily have timelines because the company, you have to get this new version out to hit the bottom line. But at the same time, then also could put you in a situation where you would be forcing software down their throats because they're using it whether you like it or not. They don't get to vote with their wallets.
Right. I mean, that's true. But one of the things that we're trying to be especially careful of is not doing that because part of our model is collecting a lot of data so that we can understand how the things that we do with our patients impact the overall quality of care that they receive and the outcomes that they achieve. And so one of the things that we know is that to get accurate data, we have to make it very easy for our clinicians to give us that data.
Right.
In order to do that, we have to build software that they want to use, not software that we're forcing them to use.
Right. And it's funny, right? Ultimately, you're asking them the same questions they're asking their patients. Where does it hurt? It's just a lot easier for them to ask it.
Yep. Yep.
What did you guys think of the keynote this morning?
Those are not problems that I deal with on a regular basis. So we're not to the point. I mean, right now we're supporting a few surgery centers. And so we don't have a ton of concurrent users. So scalability is not really something that we deal with. We're very much on the end of the spectrum that benefits from how quickly you can build something in Rails.
Right. Making your tests run faster definitely directly affects how quickly you can build something.
That's true.
But so just as a recap for people who, when they hear this podcast, will have no idea what we're talking about. Right. Eileen gave a talk, the keynote this morning. Eileen, you should tell, where she addressed like several changes that are upcoming in Rails 6 for enabling parallel tests out of the box and better enabling you to support connections to different databases at runtime, basically.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I kind of agree that most of the clients that we deal with, I haven't had that need, but we do at Thoughtbot deal with people who are larger or have really long test suites. And I'm curious to ask Eileen like how this differs from like parallel specs or something like that and what we can expect out of performance from those things.
I saw some people tweeting that, you know, they have always seen parallel tests as just a band-aid for slow or poorly written tests, which, I mean, is potentially true, but eventually, like, you just when your test suite is 10,000 tests, doesn't matter how fast they are, running that many tests is going to be slow.
When your test suite is GitHub or Shopify.
Or Shopify, right. Yeah.
Or
our test suite, you basically can only run on CI. We parallelize it over 60 different physical machines, and it still takes 20 minutes.
Yeah, I'm glad not to have those problems most of the time. I'm glad that I can run my tests locally and get output and respond quickly to those.
Yeah.
So, Sean, does that introduce the whole, like, the cartoon where it's like, I think maybe it's an XKCD or something like that, where there's like people sword fighting.
Oh, yeah.
And then so the boss comes out, he's like, what are you doing? And then the guys say, compiling. Like, carry on. Like,
yep.
Is this like, I'm waiting for CI. Okay, carry
basically,
on.
Basically, yeah. Pretty much. It makes it very frustrating I have to work on because it's like, it takes 20 minutes. That's enough time for me to go do something else. But that something else probably takes more than 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically then work on that until that needs to go to CI. And it causes just all sorts of context switches that make it a not pleasant application to work on. And parallel tests in Rails probably won't affect us that much, just because we actually, I mean, we do need to split it over multiple machines because we are parallelizing to a much higher degree than the number of CPUs on any given box. Although I suspect, you know, it will make what runs on each of those boxes faster, which will be good. I'll be interested to see how much it actually affects our runtime. I have some strong opinions about why are we shipping a thing configured that does not work on Windows out of the box. Like right now, as it's implemented, Rails' new rake test does not work on Windows. Since we are generating parallelize over two forked processes.
Well, that could be solved with some conditionals.
Sure. I think we should be threads by default, personally.
Yeah, we'll talk to Eileen. We have her on
later.
Yeah,
we will.
We won't make Nick answer for it.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
I did want to ask you, so the last episode that came out before we came to RailsConf, we talked about this blog post that Mike Montero had written about design's lost generation. I don't know if you read it. It made the rounds a couple months ago. But one of the ideas inside the piece was this idea that designers, and when Sean and I read it, we both kind of saw it as immediately applicable to developers too, might benefit from some sort of licensure. As an engineering thought leader.
Oh, gosh.
And we had discussed, Sean and I specifically talked about, like, we have no idea what would be in this. We don't know who would be responsible for it. But perhaps there would be some sort of, like, optional certification or license that you could get that is maybe focused around ethics and maybe some accessibility stuff in there, or maybe the regulations you might encounter as a software developer, that kind of thing.
I mean, I think to some degree, it's inevitable that something like that is going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that the whole Facebook thing recently has taught people is how pervasive technology can be in our lives without us even realizing it. Because I think there's plenty of people that didn't really understand what Facebook was doing with the data that they were giving them.
Mm-hmm. I still don't think they understand.
No, they probably don't. But they're seeing some of what's being done with it for the first time. And the Volkswagen thing as well. I mean, there's a question of, okay, well, whose responsibility is it really?
Right. I do think it's unfortunate that you can tell very specifically from the congressional testimonies that the people asking the questions did not understand what happened, what the implications of it are. And a lot of them just asked questions that either made no sense or were just segueing into, okay, well, regardless of what your answer, this is the point I'm trying to make. And those are going to be the people who make the rules.
Right? I think that's true of all public congressional hearings. It's an opportunity for them to get on TV and to show their constituents that they mean business. And in this case where it's Facebook, it's a win-win. Like they're not going to make anybody mad by criticizing this corporation that makes millions of money and is in billions of dollars and is having a little bit of a scandal at the moment.
Right. I think it's a major problem that the people who ultimately will be responsible for passing legislation on what restrictions are required to write software are the same people who cannot open their own email.
To play devil's advocate, like they make laws all the time that are things that are not in their area of expertise, right? And so the best we can hope for is that they have good advisors, I think.
Yeah. Well, I would hope that they establish an independent commission, something along the lines of the FDA or the FCC. Because, I mean, generally when they're passing those sorts of laws, that is what they do, is it's a law establishing a commission of people who are experts in their field and establishing what they can do and when Congress overrides them.
Right. I mean, you know, I don't think there's a lot of experts in Congress on, say, building bridges either.
Right.
But they were able to come up with effective legislation for professional engineers.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think to your point, it's going to have to be a pool of experts from the industry that inform what that could look like.
I bet if we asked a bunch of professional bridge builders, they would tell us all sorts of ways that the government regulations are wrong.
Oh, I'm sure. But,
and we would do the same if and when that comes to our field. But by and large, it would probably be for the greater good.
Right.
Right. A big part of it is just recognizing, if a bridge collapses, that can kill people or, in the best case, significantly affect people's lives. Same thing. If you are collecting social security numbers and you have a data breach, that can significantly affect people's lives.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Anything else we should ask you about?
You could ask me what I'm reading right now.
Okay. Yeah. What are you reading right now?
I'm reading The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rhodes.
Okay. And is there going to be a talk in this?
There might be. I'm trying to figure that out. I think it ties into what we were just talking about, actually, because a significant number of the scientists who were involved in the Manhattan Project walked away from the project with significant regret that they had chased the science so far because the science was so fascinating without really thinking about the actual global implications of what they were doing.
I would be fascinated to read that book. Well, I would be fascinated to hear your report on that book in talk form. And then I will probably be like, all right, I'll read the book.
Caleb gave a talk at RubyConf last year that's also in the same vein. The general point of it being, please don't make software that kills people, but telling a personal story of him being more involved in that than he wanted to because he was interested in the technical challenges and never thought about the impact that what he was building was going to have.
Yep. Had a really good slide deck.
Yeah, on the slides. I mean, you could, I'm sure they're on the internet somewhere. Definitely worth checking out the slides.
For people, they're all black. He did it without slides, which is really impressive, I think.
Yeah. But, well, it was a slide. It said this slide intentionally left blank so that people would be sure to understand that he was giving a talk without slides and not like that there was an AV problem.
Right.
which was smart.
Yeah.
That was in your track.
It was in my track. Yeah, that was a fun track.
Yeah, cool. All right. Should we wrap up?
Yeah. Sure. Nick, if people want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
They can tweet me at nmeans on Twitter or email me at nm@nickol.as.
All right. Show notes can be found at bikeshed.fm.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any of our other episodes, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on our website.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
All right.
Yeah.
This podcast was brought to you by ThoughtBot. We are experienced designers and developers who turn your idea into the right product. With local studios in Boston, San Francisco, New York, London, Austin, and Raleigh, let's build something great together.